Welcome everybody to the open discussion, so the first open discussion of the conference, and today's open discussion is on EFT Swampland and holography, and it's with the speakers of this morning session. So in particular, we have John Donahue, who gave a talk on lessons on the EFT treatment of GR, Andrew Tolley, who talked about positivity bounds and EFT, and virtually we have Johanna Erdmenger, who talked about holography and its implications for quantum gravity. Then after the coffee break, Miguel took us on a hike through the swampland, and then Sabrina told us how to piece together a flat hologram. So we already had some questions during the morning, and this is really supposed to be an open discussion, so if you have questions to either particular talk or also a question that you would like to have addressed by different speakers, now is your chance. We have two microphones that can be passed around, so please just raise your hand, and then somebody will give you a microphone. So just from the top of it, does anyone have questions to one of the speakers? Yes, Luca. Oh. Microphones can also be thrown. Yeah. So.
OK, hello. Hi. I have a question for Miguel. At some point during your talk, you said one nice feature of string theory is that it can show basically that there are many quantum gravity models that can be consistent. Like you said, tons and tons of models. But don't you think that this is a weak point of string theory? Because from my side, like if I think of predictivity, for instance, it would be nice to have a framework in which you start from some number of principles. And with this principle, you can more or less uniquely point towards one Lagrangian, one theory. And with that theory, then do experiments. If you, I don't know, get some contradiction, then you go back and try to change your starting assumption. So I would like to know better your opinion about this.
So the question is the fact that string theory has a very big landscape, a bug or a feature. So that's the question, right?
So why do you think it's a good thing to have tons and tons of possibilities?
I would say it is what it is. It's neither a bug or a feature. Of course, what you're describing sounds super nice. There's one theory. You check the predictions. It works. It doesn't work. But you know, that's not the way string theory is. It's certainly, you know, and from some points of view, that is actually a blessing. You're from connecting to holography, blah, 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 all of that, right? Because, you know, there's many, many models. You know, there could also be a good reason why it's like that. So, for instance, it could be that, you know, if you have a very big landscape of possibilities, like in string theory, you open up possibilities that some of the parameters of the universe are determined anthropically. Sort of. Like, for instance, there's this argument by Weinberg for the value of the cosmological constant. It's an anthropic argument. Basically, you know, suppose that the cosmological constant is as little fine-tuned as possible so that there can be galaxies. And so that clearly sounds anthropic, and it works. You get the right value, so, you know, it opens up more possibilities. It's just, you know, it's just the way it is. I don't think that we can decide on, you know, whether string theory is the right or wrong theory to describe the universe based on that feature. You know, it's just a feature it happens to have, and it has both positive and perhaps negative. I don't know if I answered the question.
Yeah, I think so. So basically, you're not worried about this huge plethora of possibilities, let's say.
Well, you know, it makes more complicated the job of finding what's the right one. But maybe, you know, it makes you think anthropically. Maybe the part of the answer is that, you know, there has to be a landscape so that some things can be selected like this. I don't know.
Okay, thanks.
Maybe I can actually follow up on a question on that. So, like, during the talk, it sounded like most of these constraints and the conjectures are kind of trivially or, like, satisfied in string theory and all of the examples. So does it mean that the swampland program in the end does not put additional constraints on string theory to figure out whether the whether string theory is actually a theory that describes nature, as we observe it?
So I think that's absolutely right. So for instance, every string compactification satisfies swampland, because if we find one that doesn't satisfy a putative swampland constraint, we know that swampland constraint is wrong because we found a concrete quantum gravity model where it's not true. So you know, if somebody came and tell you, oh yeah, here's the standard model in string theory, we found it's this compactification, then you could forget about swampland. You already found the right answer. The whole point of swampland is trying to extrapolate what can you say generally without having to know the details, because we just don't know the details. It's like, okay, fine. Suppose, you know, that the standard model is somewhere in the string landscape. Well, what would the distance conjecture would imply? Can we say something interesting about phenomenology without having to know the concrete Calabi-Yau or the concrete whatever, if anything, that gives you the standard model? That's the philosophy.
All right, and I guess John wants to comment on this.
Just following up, can you do it in reverse? So let's imagine the swampland proves that positive cosmological constant is in the swampland. Does that falsify string theory?
Well, actually, no. What I would make, that would actually, you know, that would be awesome, because that would be a very strong prediction that what we are observing is not a constant, which is actually compatible with experiments. So, you know, there's, for instance, a satellite Euclid, which was launched in summer. They're going to measure effectively the slope of the potential. You know, it's compatible with zero, but it's not constrained to be zero. It can be V prime over V up to 0.3. I think it's fine. Okay? So if string theory, which is not the case, by the way, right now, if string theory or the swamp plan, I want to make clear that it's not the case right now.
It could be.
But suppose that somebody made some sort of, like, I think we're going to hear on Friday about, you know, the sitter from string theory from Fernando, so clearly it's, you know, it's not a subtle thing. But suppose tomorrow the definitive paper comes out on archive and there's no the sitter in string theory, then string theory is actually making a very concrete prediction that it's either, you know, V prime over V bigger than zero or effects of curvature. There was a paper about this. You know, like, you have the spatial slices of the universe you can put with negative curvature or positive curvature that can generalize things. Yeah, so that would be a super concrete prediction from string theory and one we would be able to test. So if that paper came out tomorrow and then we don't find accelerated expansion, then I would say string theory is wrong. But only once you exhaust all the possibilities.
Thank you. There's a question by Renato.
Okay, hi. I have a question for Andrew. So the whole setup you presented there, of course, you stated a whole bunch of, you know, principles which we all love right at the beginning, you know, causality, locality, unitarity, and Poincaré invariance. So, you know, when I'm thinking about, okay, you know, Planckian physics, people draw little quantum forms, etc. So I would think, you know, the first thing to go would clearly be Poincaré invariance or Lorentz invariance. So am I right in thinking, however, that in your setup, that was a very crucial element of the construction, and not, you know, not dragging the out all the way to the Planck scale, but, you know, having a non-Minkowskian background, having a non-zero cosmological constant, could you incorporate that in a straightforward way?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think, I was trying to be quite precise about the assumptions that go in, you know, any of which in principle you could give up. If I was to say what was first to go, I would suspect it was actually probably the locality assumption rather than Lorentz invariance, but I think it depends a little bit on your taste. But if you give up, so analyticity, of course, was understood in non-relativistic theories first, so you didn't need Lorentz invariance to make the argument about causality and analyticity. It was originally all done for non-relativistic potential scattering in non-relativistic theories. The Lippmann-Schwinger equation exhibits analyticity. So Lorentz invariance isn't important for those arguments.
I'm not, you know, talking about relativistic versus non-relativistic. So, of course, if you may have non-relativistic, but still Euclidean, you know, invariance and rotational invariance. So I mean a situation where these global invariances are just not there.
Yeah. So I was just, so where that's sort of crucial in this, is that it reduces the answer down to just a function of those Mandelstam invariants, and then you run the analyticity in those variables, and then also you have crossing symmetry. So if you don't enforce that from the outset, you can't guarantee crossing, which is actually quite crucial in the power of the bounds. If you give up the crossing symmetry, then you lose a lot of the constraint. So certainly breaking any amount of the Poincaré variance in the UV, even if it's only mild, would weaken the statements. They'd still be statements, but it would weaken.
And having a small cosmological constant flow.
Yeah, so what people are trying to do, and emphasize the word trying, is to generalize some of these arguments to cosmological spacetimes. And the first obvious thing would be to try and do it for De Sitter. So there's initial obstacles in the sense that you don't have an S matrix on De Sitter. But you can look for similar quantities. So there's people that approach it from the point of view of, say, you know, people talk about evaluating the wave function of the universe, you know, which is essentially looking at the future boundary and looking at correlators at the future boundary, and then trying to do some arguments there. At the moment, that's not well developed at all. And most of the statements that are made are perturbative tree-level statements, and so can't be really, you can't... So the real power of the positivity bounds is that you're not putting constraints on the low energy that the low energy has to satisfy. You're making an assumption that the UV has to satisfy that then feeds back into the low energy. That's the real power. So a lot of the statements when you hear, you may hear talks about cosmological bootstrap and so on, the optimism, the hope of that is to provide statements of a similar strength as the S-matrix ones. But at the moment, most of it is just statements on the low energy effective theory that are constraints that will automatically satisfy. But there is a hope there. You know, De Sitter has the same amount of symmetry as Minkowski, right? It's the same amount, and maybe it's just a question of finding the right observable and the right choice of variables. Certainly, there is some analyticity. You know, you can write a Chalin-Lehmann spectral representation down in De Sitter space. It's a bit more complicated, but it still exists. You can write, expand things in terms of the various representations of De Sitter. There clearly unitarity is still true, so there must be buried positivity. So all that is there. So there should be, if we phrase the question the right way, a way to do it. But I have to say, at the moment, no one has really come up with a definitive way to do it. There's attempts, but it's
non-uniqueness might also appear. A non-uniqueness in this construction in De Sitter.
Sorry, I didn't...
A non-uniqueness might sneak in there also.
Yes,
as we know.
Yeah. But it is interesting. I mean, it's the normal story. I'm not saying anything new, but, you know, De Sitter has the same amount of symmetry as ADS, but, you know, you go to De Sitter and there's not much you can say in some sense in these things.
Right, there was a question for Carla.
Yeah, it's a follow-up for you and also for John. I appreciate this way of putting it, putting clearly some assumptions and then seeing what they imply, and at the same time sort of questioning which one, asking the question which one these assumptions physically could go up. And you just said that locality is the one you would be most suspicious first. Now, When there was a discussion during your talk, there was something like that, but then at some point you mentioned long-range interaction, I don't know, wormholes or whatever. Just to clarify, would you agree that the interesting part of locality which is suspicious has nothing to do with long distance? It has to do with locality failing at short scale in a way which nevertheless it would be consistent. That's why the question goes to John as well. With a local effective field theory up to some scale. Would that be, the reason, of course, I'm asking that is because I come from loop quantum gravity, where that's something like that is what one expects, namely that universe is well described by local field theory up to some scale. When you get close to the Planck scale, then non-perturbative phenomena just destroy the possibility of a naive quantum local quantum field theory discovery. Is that, would that consistent with what you're saying, both of you?
So, is this just me or to you? My answer is that I don't think there has to be an assumption that it's a local quantum field theory at high energies. It could be discrete. I think the assumptions that go into it, though, are somehow that there are some of those features, some of the usual features of quantum mechanics survive at low energies. And that where the world is approximately four-dimensional, continuous at low energies. And to the extent that that approximation is true, the uncertainty principle holds. And so there is the set of assumptions that I think I tried to, well, it's actually we're into the afternoon discussion later on, the panel discussion, where I was going to say some of those things, that there are some assumptions on any quantum field theory that is has to do with the four-dimensional character of the world, the quantum mechanics holding on those scales. We can give those up potentially for any theory in the effective field theory. I think if you, given the usual set of assumptions for usual field theories, the techniques of the effective field theory are still applicable. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think there is the potential that some of the.
Sorry, John, if you're talking, then please use the microphone.
Some of the things that we think of on everyday scales, like locality or causality, cannot be true on short distance scales, and that'd be interesting if that was the case.
The super naive picture of in mind, I mean, take QCD, which is a local field theory, of course. Imagine that I'm a fan of QCD on a lattice. And imagine that the universe is really like a lattice at some very, very small scale. Okay, that's a perfectly consistent theory that would be consistent with QCD, which would be very hard to think in terms of local quantum field theory at all energies. It just wouldn't work.
Right, and so lattice is a great example of a theory that on the fundamental scales is in fact discrete. It violates some of our assumptions. Yeah. Yet as you go down, if you take big enough lattices with small enough spacing, the approximate symmetry is rotationally invariant, gauge invariant, smooth. It has all the properties that we assume of our low energy theories, yet on the fundamental scale is quite different. So the smoothness is an emergent property, if you want, of a lattice. And we see it works. It's lovely. It's a lovely example.
So is that what connected to what we're saying, locality could be the weak physical assumption?
Yeah, so I agree with what you're saying. I think all we require phenomenologically is macroscopic causality and macroscopic locality. I think if the theory doesn't look like an effective theory at low energies, there's going to be other problems showing up.
Yes.
So I think, and just to play devil's advocate, of course, these 1960s assumptions, they were not thinking about gravity at the time. It was a framework, you know, axiomatic quantum field theory or analytic S matrix program. And they were not thinking about gravity. So it was these are assumptions you expect to have to be true for a field theory, a non-gravitational field theory. So I think the question is, how much of that should we extrapolate to a gravitational theory? Of course, historically, string theory came from this. And so it's perhaps arguably not too surprising that string theory satisfies those. So it's string theory, despite being made of strings, it still preserves some notion of locality in the sense of, it certainly has analyticity and in terms of growth of amplitudes. But as I say, I think if you give up the analyticity, things go crazy a bit fast, although I think John has thought about this. We've got an explicit example. But then there's a danger of, there's perhaps more serious danger. Whereas the locality is, you know, certainly phenomenologically just isn't required. And a sort of toy example is you know, people talk about, that I like to give is TT bar deformations, two-dimensional theories. And there's a parameter in that deformation. And there's specific examples of, if you take an integrable theory, you can deform it in a particular way and still write down the S matrix. And there's a parameter in that deformation that you can choose two signs for it. And if you choose one sign, the theory basically becomes non-local in the sense its amplitudes are not polynomially, not even exponentially bounded. And yet you can write down its S matrix elements. So it exists in the sense it has an S matrix. It's analytic, it's crossing symmetric. Well, it's trivial in two dimensions, but it satisfies all the requirements, unitarity, etc., but it's just non-local. And you can write it down. And so there is an argument to say perhaps there's two classes of quantum gravity theories. One that preserve locality in the UV, and string theory was designed to do that. That's where it came from. But maybe there's another class which doesn't do that. And I'm certainly open to that possibility.
I think there's a question online.
There are questions from the chat. So the first question is a question for Joanna, which she, the person is Faisal Barzi, is asking whether gravity is often seen as a double copy of gauge theory. And the person is asking whether this relation can be interpreted as a duality as you defined it during your talk.
Yes, hello. While I'm talking, maybe can I just shortly answer the question which was asked to me after my talk about where large 1 over n corrections come in the definition of the Berry phase. If you remember, somebody asked this, is this person still there? Then I would just answer this in 30 seconds and then come to the question which was just asked.
Just go ahead.
Yeah, okay, so the question was asked, so I introduced this Berry phase as I mentioned, as a means to determine whether von Neumann algebras are type 3 or type 2. And somebody asked the very intelligent questions, if I compare this to this approach based on this cross product and the center of the algebra where the 1 over n corrections come in. And if I may just quickly answer this. Berry phase is based on this two-sided black hole. And so I have one CFT on one hand side and the other CFT on the other side. And at each side, there is a symmetry, actually a compact U1 symmetry, which comes from the phase factor involving this Hamiltonian. And I define the Berry phase with respect to that in the large N limit. Now, if I include 1 over N corrections, our Berry phase, which is defined for the so-called thermofield double state, gets 1 over n corrections, and this actually leads to the fact that this U1 phase becomes decompactified and I get a line. And so in the 1 over n corrections lead to this line being present rather than just a phase. And that will actually mean that the Berry phase vanishes, and then I can define a trace functional for the maximally entangled state. I hope that was a helpful answer.
Yes, so Abai, who asked the question, seems happy with it. All right. And then maybe we can follow up with a question in the chat, and maybe Celine can read
yes,
it again.
Okay, then I'll answer the next question. So the next question was about the duality in the case for the...
Just read it again, please.
It was just about whether, like, the fact to interpret gravity as a double copy in field theory can be described as a duality as you defined it?
Yes, that's also an excellent question. And I think in the broad picture is, of course, yes, in the sense that I have one theory made out of gravitons, and then I have two copies of a theory made out of non-abelian gauge fields, and so they're related to each other. And I mean, in the very general picture, I would say this is a duality. I mean, there's some small differences. One is that, as far as I understand, I'm not an expert on double copy, but as far as I understand, it's based on amplitudes and kinematics, whereas I was advocating dualities at the level of actions. Okay, I mean, not saying that in the usual form of the ADS-CFT correspondence, we can actually already say how that works, but that would be the claim. And the other small difference, as far as I understand, is that at least in the weak form, ADS-CFT is a strong weak duality. So the field theory is strongly coupled and the gravity is weakly coupled. And I think probably in double copy, since that's at the level of amplitudes, I think you in the perturbative regime on both sides of that duality. But okay, that's small points. And I think it's fair to say that this is a duality according to my definition.
Right. Thank you very much. And I think Celine indicated that there's another question online.
There is a question by Francisco Bento Lustosa that says, there is a recent growth in interest in quantum theory where collapses and entanglements somehow could be mediated by quantum gravitational effects. One example is Penrose model, but there are other like correlated word line theory. And the person is asking, what is the opinion of John and the panel on the possibility that there is something at the foundation of quantum mechanics that could help answer some problems in quantum gravity?
Any opinions on that?
Well, I mean, maybe this is not very helpful. I will just say that if I understand the question correctly, it's about whether there's something we should change the quantum mechanics, or if the actual foundations of quantum mechanics are compatible with quantum gravity.
Yeah, something in that direction.
Yeah. I will just say that I don't know, but for instance, we do have examples of consistent quantum gravities which are consistent with all the ordinary rules of quantum mechanics, like string theory. So I would say it's not necessary to deform quantum mechanics for quantum gravity, you know, to get a consistent model of quantum gravity. Now the question is, you know, does that class of theories where you don't nullify quantum mechanics, you know, get you the real world? That we don't know. But at least as a point of principle, can you do quantum gravity without modifying quantum mechanics? I think the answer is yes.
Right. John, yeah, maybe you take
that. Oh, sorry. I have a question for Andrew, so in QCD, the gluon propagator violates Shillen-Lehman representation. And that's generally written off because it's a gauge current. Isn't that the same? Isn't that an issue then for the quantum gravity case? Most of the correlations that you're doing are of gravitons. And how are they different from the QCD case, and why do they have to violate? Why can't they violate things like Shillen-Lehman?
Yeah, so I think that's why, certainly the Shillen-Lehman type things can't be done for gravity, and that it's the same story as well. The simplest answer is they're not field redefinition independent. And that's why, say, typically these bootstrap or positivity bands are phrased at the level of the S matrix elements, because they're field redefinition independent. And if you... So I think the only thing, say when you run the positivity bounds or the bootstrap bounds with gravity, all you're doing is assuming there is an S matrix which includes gravity. So that could be an S matrix for graviton scattering, or just an S matrix for scalar scattering with a gravitons exchanged. And those things are at least okay at tree level. And the only problem is the IR divergence problem. And then people have the ways to get around that. But I think these issues, in some sense, the IR divergence is just in the IR, so it should be separate from these issues. So I think the main problem with gravity, adding gravity in this story, is related to the T-channel pole and the branch cut going all the way down to zero, and there's no mass gap, and so on and so on.
I mean, along the same lines, the analyticity arguments. There are momentum space arguments, but that's Fourier transforms of correlation functions. If the space-time is not well-defined, why are we expecting analyticity then in gravitational physics at the highest energies?
So I think that comes back to the same point. I mean, if there's extra structure at small distances, then you might expect either a failure of Poincaré or a failure of locality, or failure of analyticity. So indeed, all of those things could be given up in principle. I think it depends a little bit on your taste, which one you're going to give up first. Maybe anyone else?
I guess when I heard the question, I would somehow think that what you were saying is if things go wrong in the bulk, then because I'm doing this LSD formulation where I'm Fourier transforming these bulk correlators, that something goes wrong. But I feel like for a lot of the situation, even for the cosmological correlators, we just want things to be like well-defined when we Fourier transform along the conformal boundary.
I think the question was not so much about the bulk, right, but was whether, I mean, if there isn't maybe a notion of space-time at small distances, then it's not even clear we should be, you know, thinking about Fourier transforms at high energies.
To what extent am I worried about like the bulk not like being discrete or something weird happening when I really just need the conformal boundary Fourier transform? I mean, I don't know how I can make analysis arguments from that, but I feel like it's a little bit safer.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing as it's how you get away with it in ADS-CFT. You look at the boundary, and here you get away with it by looking at the S matrix elements. We are assuming there is an S matrix that exists in momentous space, and it's Lorentz invariant.
Another question for Sabrina. So are you guys at some point in celestial holography comparing, you know, like with matrix theory or all the other attempts that have been done in string theory to try and understand flat space quantum gravity? You know, just like this matrix theory in 11 dimensions.
There are definitely papers I can point you to with the Strominger group on like the BFSS like matrix model. I still think that it's like in those cases, it's kind of case by case trying to just find something that they can like look like these currents or they match soft theorems. So it's not really very fundamental, I would feel like. In those cases. Anything with like the light cone kind of structure they can do.
Yeah, actually, I also have a question to you, Sabrina. So I think it was to reply to Fernando after your talk. You mentioned something like everything that ADS-CFT can do, we can also do in a flat limit. So are there limitations to that statement? And then maybe also a follow-up, like, can I view it as a step to DS holography? So from ADS-CFT to flat space to DS-CFT, like some form of DS holography? And maybe can you highlight whether there are qualitative fundamental difficulties that still are there, or whether it's really just the next step?
Sure. Okay, so maybe let me take that back as a challenge rather than an assertion that I could personally do the flat limit stuff. So basically, what I'm saying is that there's a sense in which I think the Kodomachin 2 description kind of throws people off and thinks it's like it's going to be so different. But a lot of the structures are interesting things where you're using ADS-CFT to extract S-matrix elements. You can see how to carry it through. And then obviously one big thing that you don't have is like when you take the cosmological constant to zero and suddenly like you have a bunch of compactified dimensions that now blow up, you don't land on like the flat top-down construction. So there's things that you definitely can't just take the flat limit of and know that you know what you're doing. But then the second part of your question is I do agree that we want to see celestials somewhere between the ADS and the de Sitter case. And especially, like, we view things on the conformal boundary the same way that you do in ADS and the same way that these de Sitter, wave functions of the universe and or correlators on, like, on Scry there are set up. I think that the difference between going from, going through flat from, like, ADS to DS, you do kind of run into this issue of an in and out. And so there's something kind of different just in principle of like you're not really normally necessarily looking at like time evolution on the boundary and asking for it to be unitary. The notion of the thing that you want to be unitary is like completeness of kind of the states going into then evolving to the out state. So there are definitely interesting features there that kind of give you a taste of, I think, problems that you have in the de Sitter case. And I'll let someone who does de Sitter add if they want.
Yes, there's a remark or is it a remark like on this?
Oh, okay.
Then maybe we can take Abai first and then go over.
I mean, this question came up a few times, not only to you, but to other mm-hmm. people also. Basically, you know, DS versus asymptotically flat versus ADS. And as you pointed out, in the ADS case, we've got time-like boundary. And so it's qualitatively different. Boundary conditions might have to change. But I just wanted to point out that in the case of DS, for some reason, people always look at, you know, scry minus and scry plus, which are both all three spheres and so on. But in some ways, if we actually have an observer or, you know, a radiating system or anything like that, I mean, particles, then it is much easier to consider 2 points on scry plus, scry minus. It's like I plus and I minus, if you like. And then look at the event horizons coming in. And then what you get is really the analog of local scry. And if you do it carefully, you can see that in ADS, in DS, if you take lambda equal to zero limit, then all you get is this patch of space-time, which is really looks exactly like Minkowski space, which is what you should get. Namely, that what was the past event horizon of I plus becomes scry plus of Minkowski space-time, the future event horizon of I minus becomes. So I think this really is a much better way of understanding the relation between DS and asymptotically flat situations. And I think a lot of progress actually can be done in this particular way. But for gravitational waves, for example, one can actually do a lot of progress in this case in the full nonlinear theory. But also, I mean, in fact, some of the things that Sabrina was talking about, you know, the celestial holography, scry minus, scry plus, I think many of them could be actually transferred to this local scry minus and local scry plus in DS. And that might be a, you know, more physically relevant approximation to, more physically relevant paradigm to use. It's not an approximation, just a paradigm.
I think there's a question by Raquel, who was first.
Yeah. First, I had a question for Sabrina about in celestial holography, could you explain how do we build a possible quantum gravity theory? Like, would it be contained in the chiral algebra? Is that the idea? Like, are all the observables we care about at low energy, they are described by the gravitational matrix, but in general, like with the goal of building a theory of quantum gravity, what does celestial holography do?
I would say that one downside of a lot of the bottom-up story is that we really are like dealing with a perturbative bulk, and we're basically building in whatever like fields we want there. So whatever the graviton gives us, this stress tensor gives us this possibly W infinity, but at least gives us a supertranslation current too. And then you can add other field content and get more symmetries. So I think that the like trying to really like have the full theory in some sense would like you need to assert that there is a holographic principle and then look for intrinsically defined Carolian theories or something on the conformal boundary with the currents that you want. And that's where in Kevin's work with Natalie and with Atul, they do have this very weird construction from this like weird thing they're doing to strings examples where they have the same symmetry algebras. And just by the nature of them having the same symmetry algebras, if we kind of asserted that that is what we like want to imagine either side of the duality, that this like we would look for a dual that has those symmetries, then they've given us a top-down construction. But again, like I think the better thing would be to probably relax like the W infinity and just go for like certain like Carolian fluids or something and try to like. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And I also have another question for everyone, that is about phenomenology. Because in many talks, like it was said that quantum gravity is very difficult because like M Planck is very large. But I don't know, many friends that work in fields that are maybe more related to phenomenology say in many different times that with their experiments, they are going to probe things that are quantum gravity, like cosmologists or people that work in black hole mergers. So I would like to know, what are your research programs doing to try to answer questions that maybe can be compared with experimental data in like the following, like in the next 20 years?
I let you guys, because otherwise you should go first and I'll go second. Like, are they disproving string theory by measuring the cosmological constant? Sorry.
You want to go?
Yeah, maybe I'll start because Coming at it from a cosmologist perspective, I mean, I think so. When we work with EFTs, we're parameterizing our ignorance, and so there's a question of like, you know, what is the cutoff scale? And from a phenomenological point of view, the cutoff scale is simply the scale that we've probed to yet. So if you want to know about corrections to gravity, if general relativity could be different at high energies in any possible way, from a phenomenological point of view, simply ask, you know, what constraints do we have so far? And there are some good constraints, but not quite as good as you think. For example, you know, we've only tested Newton's law down to like, whatever it is now, 10 microns, to micron scale. So not very small distances. And so that's why, you know, there's often been a lot of excitement about large extra dimensions and so on, because that brings in new physics at those scales, and that's where the constraint is. So in terms of what scale we should imagine for new physics, we should simply just parameterize it based on what tests have been done so far. And it's in that sense, I think, you know, when cosmologists might be excited about high energy corrections to the inflation model and so on, you just parameterize it by some scale and you ask, you know, what scale does it need to be? So whatever that scale is has to be higher than the Hubble scale during inflation, otherwise inflation won't work. But it doesn't have to be too much higher. And so if it isn't too much higher, there's potential chance of observable effects. So there could be new physics, you know, at a couple of orders of magnitude above the Hubble scale. There's no notion it has to be at the Planck scale. So that's, it looks like the mic went. So I would say we should just parameterize. And then we just push our tests of gravity, be they through, short distance tests or black hole tests and so on, and push them as far as possible and ask whether there's any correction at that. And that's the sort of experimentalist perspective.
Maybe, essentially I agree with what Andrew just said. From the point of view of, you know, like swamp land, you're just trying to find exactly what are, you know, I guess your question was originally why, you know, where we're saying that it's so difficult to connect when there's some other people say they can be connected. First of all, in cosmology, as Andrew was saying, it's not so crazy. Like, if you have inflation, for instance, at, you know, 10 to the 13 GeV, that's perhaps not so far from Planck scale. So maybe you can hope by constraining cosmological parameters, you can say something there. Then also with the extra dimensions, for instance, like we have this prediction, which is like taking strong forms of Swampland principles, we get one extra dimension of size a micrometer, like a few micrometers. That's something that people are actually checking. We will actually know in a few years if that scenario works or is ruled out. There was one more point you mentioned, which was like the binaries, the mergers. So that one, there's different opinions. I'm not so optimistic because the curvature, what's going to control what kind of new physics you get there, is going to be the curvature scales of the black holes that are merging. Okay, it's not so much their mass, but the curvatures of the horizon. And you know, I checked that once, and it comes out to like, you know, electron balls or, yeah, that's the scale that you're probing. And I think we have a pretty good handle on those from all the points of view. So unless there's like drastic modification of GR, or I would say that's not the best probe. It doesn't sound to me. Maybe you'll have
different opinion. Talk a little bit about the experiment that Vafa talked about at a string stock, if you remember.
Yes. That's related to this extra dimension scenario, this dark dimension scenario. So there's a group by Markus Spellmeyer, and they're just trying to push the standard constraints on extra dimensions, large extra dimensions. Okay, so the state of the art of that is from 2021. So people have measured up to 30 micrometers. There's no extra dimension which is larger than 30 micrometers. The I'm not really that familiar with the details, but the point is that when you're in the few microns range, the way people try to measure violations of Newton's laws is with still, at least in this approach, with torsion balance. They just have like two plates with a string, and then just measure like the torque that's induced by gravity. And this is how it was done originally by Jotbos in the 19th century. And the difficulty is that when the plates get too close, you start getting hit by van der Waals forces. So you need to model those adequately. And so it becomes a problem of that's very difficult. And I'm not really the right person to say more.
And then I want to close with, it's not about testing quantum gravity, but I do love that one thing, Celestial, because you're looking at these like IR observables, you can kind of test the approximation of being aesthetically flat with these memory effects. I think, although probably I'll overstate it, it's neat that they're actually using like BMS like frames in the kind of comparing the numerics to then what they would like analytically want to make sure that the mass loss is consistent. So they're improving their waveforms with knowledge of the symmetry. So I think that's really cool. And then some of the like I guess correlation functions of like Anik operators or their charge equivalents were appearing in like early tests of QCD. So there's interesting contact with Fino with the objects that we look at, which is fun. But it's not testing quantum gravity.
Great. I see two questions. I think John was first and then Fernando.
Yeah, a few comments. First of all, we should be reminded almost a century that we've been doing quantum gravity. And during that time, thousands of papers have been published. I've also published my quantum gravity theory, which is, I claim, divided finite, self-consistent. I can produce a scattering amplitude for you, graviton-graviton scattering, graviton-mass scattering, which is finite, but I can't test it directly because there are no quantum gravity data. So we fall back to black holes. So we can't see inside a black hole. It takes 10 to 67 years for a black hole to evaporate by Hawking radiation. Also, Hawking radiation is nano Kelvin degrees temperature. We can't test it. So the question is, we have to concentrate on how we can experimentally test quantum gravity, because there are many quantum gravity theories. We all claim our theory is consistent. We claim that it's correct, and so on. How can you do theoretical physics without experimental data?
Wait, can I take this on? Okay, this is going to be really like off the wall. So like, I'm sorry, but it's a little funny. So what I think is really cool is like when I used to. But when you're in a position where you have to basically talk about a field but you don't feel like you've been a part of long enough to reasonably do it, you're always like, oh, I'm studying quantum gravity. And you have no clue what it really means to be saying that you're doing that, right? Like you're standing on shoulders of giants. But I guess it's kind of fun to think about, like, why are we studying quantum gravity? It's because right now we have this knowledge canon that kind of split off between our understanding of classical mechanics and then going to quantum mechanics versus going to, like, special relativity and GR. And we want to basically condense and connect that canon. And I think the cool thing about it is if we are studying things that are so much further away from experimental verification, then the thing that we value is making sure that whenever we're ready for an experiment, that it's easy to access efficiently that canon and basically not have efforts be repeated. And so what I love about Celestial is it's kind of this microcosm of like saying that there is value in literally just saying this different things are the same thing. Because if you have knowledge in different knowledge canons, I guess like in math versus in physics, if you know how to translate the assumptions, that's where real progress happens. So I personally, if I was gonna make a bet on how to deal with the issue of connecting to experiment, would be like, let's like scale up a translation problem or like really try to like manage the kind of the information that we're adding to this ever-growing like knowledge canon in a way that maybe now there's more tools to do so. And so that's not really a physics question, but it's a physicist question, and it's a cool problem that I think we're starting to have access to need like capabilities to do so. So I'm excited.
I should add, by the way, though.
Do you want to add something on that, Andrew, or since you're holding the mic? So.
I think if you have a specific quantum gravity theory, which I think is you're thinking of, where there's just new physics at the Planck scale, then that may be hard to test, unless it's Breaks-Lorentz invariance, which is easier to test. Probe new physics. But I think also, just going back to the previous point, I think also what we're imagining and what many people have imagined is that there may just be new physics at lower energy scales. And that is true in many theories, be it, say, the string scale, which is lower than the Planck scale, or be it large extra dimensions and so on. And those kind of things do have, you know, if they exist, they will have observable effects if the scale is about right, and so can look for those. So it depends a little bit on your assumption about what your model is.
Should I?
Sorry, John, we have several other questions. There's Fernando and also Abai just raised his hand. So we might postpone it to later. If we have time, we come back to it. But now, Fernando, please.
Okay, so thank you. So, well, related to the phenomenology question, I wanted to add a little bit more comments about what I said.
Sorry, John. Oh. We have a couple of other questions, so we need to move on. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah. So go ahead, Fernando.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. So, just related to the phenomenology question, I wanted to add some more comments from what Eva said. So, as Miguel said, we had the problem with this. The Planck scale is so high that we cannot imagine since having an experiment there. And also we have been a bit frustrated because of LHC hasn't found anything new. So in that sense, we are in a difficult situation at the moment. But there are things that are going on. So in particular, searches for axions. So axions, you know, that excellent candidate for dark matter. And if they are discovered, there will be giving you some hints. For instance, string theory has many axions, and so there will be the coupling, the scale, the mass, and so on, that there could be a relevant thing that can put some constraints. There are other things like the tensor modes for the density perturbations. So in the next 5 to 10 years, people will be testing the parameter R, which is a tensor over a scalar, and to another order of magnitude below. So if you see something there, that would be a very strong indication about the high energy physics. It's a very, very high energy. So it can be string theory or something else, but it will tell you that there is something there. The other thing is that gravitational waves. Gravitational waves is the new biggest, the big thing, and it will only get better and better with time. So of course you will see that people now are exploring between, you know, the kilohertz and below. LISA will explore at much lower frequencies, and that will be something that may be giving us some information if they discover something new. But what I am a bit more excited is about the other region, the from the kilohertz up, so gigahertz or megahertz, gigahertz. You do back on the envelope calculations, you see that the higher the frequency is the higher the energy that you are testing. So you want to test the God scale, say 10 to the 17 GeV or so, that will give you the gigahertz scale. And so it is thinkable that in the next 30, 40 years, people will come up with ideas to have to. So the problem that with that is that there have been some experiments being planned, but the precision is not good enough. But it's in a better situation than LIGO was 40 years ago. So in that sense, you may expect that, and that will be a way to test. The good thing about high-frequency gravitational waves is that there are no astrophysical backgrounds, so there are no black holes or anything else. It's, whatever you will see will be new physics. So in that sense, that will be very promising. And since you're young, it will be nice for you, but probably not good for me.
And Abai raised his hand earlier.
Yeah, I think this question came up several times again about these testable predictions. I think you said that well. There's no testable prediction at all. Oh, I think that cosmology, actually, the early universe, provides a very good arena for that. And I think that, for example, people are talking about black holes, but even at the onset of inflation, that is to say when the... Okay, let me just say onset of inflation. That is to say when the mode with the largest wavelength observable exited the Hubble horizon. The curvature is about 10 to the 65 times that on the horizon of a solar mass black hole, 10 to the 65 times. And of course, in any quantum gravity theory will also want to go back and say what happened before onset of inflation, what happens at the Big Bang singularity. And then there will be signatures of it, perhaps in the anomalies that we see in the cosmic microwave background, perhaps on non-Gaussianities, and of course, as was said about on the B-mode polarization. So to me, I think in the reasonably near future, there might be really signatures of quantum gravity effects, most likely in the early universe than anywhere else. I mean in a matter of a decade or perhaps a decade and a half.
Yeah, I think that's right. And not only are the scales closer in cosmology, but also, say, to ask questions about, you know, initial conditions for inflation or initial conditions. I mean, you know, it still remains that the best candidate for initial conditions is like the no boundary proposal. And not that I'm saying that's necessarily right, but you'd have to understand, you do have to understand the interplay between quantum theory and gravity to understand the early universe. It's crucial. And it may be that when we understand that, we actually see that there's a definitive prediction from that, or something that would be clearly measurable potentially in the future. So I think it is important. So cosmology is certainly up there.
Any other reactions?
And I just want to agree, like the tensor to scatter ratio, as Fernando was mentioning, or something like that, it's probably the best window. And you know, maybe like, you know, if part fraction of the dark matter is black holes, you know, like primordial black holes, understanding how those were produced, all that. So there's definitely a lot of to understand there, like from dark matter.
I think we have a question up there.
Yeah, so talking about initial conditions and symmetries, I was wondering whether you have some insight of how the thermodynamic era of time can emerge from a more fundamental description, and if quantum gravity has anything to say about that, or maybe even string theory. Does string theory say anything about it?
Was that directed to anyone specific, or just?
Yeah, to the panel in general.
Any volunteers?
I will just say that at least, you know, in string theory, there's, you know, it's really not that, the way we understand it right now, it's not that different from, you know, we don't really understand very well, I would say, the problem of initial conditions, okay? So we're busy, we have our hands full trying to find the effective field theory that describes our universe, okay, without, never mind asking the questions. There's some work trying to understand how the landscape is populated, transitions from one vacuum to another. But even that begs the question of what's, you know, the initial state. So the questions about like how does the era of time emerge? They are related to, you know, what's the initial state, and you know, then is the evolution from that just creating like some effective irreversibility at the at the semi-classical level. But I don't think it's that different from, you know, quantum field theory, right? Quantum field theory is time symmetric, and if you have the right kind of state that evolves, it's kind of like chaotic, it can generate an effective era of time.
Okay, so I might have a question for Johanna, actually. So, Johanna, you mentioned at some point the discrete holography, and then mentioned that there might be a connection to dynamical triangulations, and was just wondering whether you could elaborate a little bit, like, do you want to use dynamical triangulation to probe this discrete holography, or what exactly would the connection be?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So, okay, so I mean, we still don't have a proof of ADS CFT, and so I started with this very generic statement about what the duality is, and so the idea of this discrete holography is to find a new example where this duality works, where we don't have these things we know and love, like continuous manifolds. And so it's a program of establishing the duality for these discrete systems. And as I mentioned, so the holographic principle should hold, and also the symmetries should match. And so in some recent work that I didn't have time to explain in detail, what we actually did is to write down a spin train up the boundary. Okay, we started in very low dimensions. Okay, so just ADS2 with a one-dimensional boundary. We wrote down a spin train whose couplings are inspired by the construction principle for these triangulation for these polygons in the bulk. Okay, and so then we wrote down a Hamiltonian at the boundary, and using tensor networks we can reconstruct the bulk space. But for real duality, what we are missing is to have a dynamical theory on this discrete lattice in the bulk, okay? And so one interest in finding something there would also, if you remember towards the beginning of the talk, I mentioned that there's these different limits in the ADS-CFT correspondence, and a very important limit is to take n, the rank of the gauge group, to infinity, which of course is very restrictive because it essentially takes you to a subtle point approximation of a classical theory. Okay, so I was also looking for new ideas to look at the 1 over n corrections, which would then also lead us towards the quantum side, quantum aspects of the gravity side of the correspondence. And so I just thought a new idea of making some statements about quantum gravity in this context is to make use of all this beautiful work on dynamical triangulations. So, and so this led me to the question, I mean, can you do dynamical triangulations also for other polygons? I don't know, pentagons, heptagons, whatever. And so of course, let them fluctuate in the sense as the triangles do. And so if we can do that, then maybe we can have a new approach to 1 over n corrections to the ADS-CFT correspondence, which would then bring us closer to making statements about quantum gravity proper, which is very hard at the level of string theory because we can't do strongly coupled string theory in a curved space background. So that would be a new approximation that we could do. So that was the idea.
Right. Thank you very much. And I think Renata.
Yes, yeah, I was also curious. I would have asked if Mark had asked. So
I'm also curious about your answer, Renata.
So I was. You are talking about Euclidean, right? This is Euclidean signature.
So far, it's Euclidean. Yeah.
So definitely. Well, of course, we are only interested really in models where a continual limit is taken, right? So I don't know whether you want to keep the polygons finite or you want to take that limit.
Well, I mean, at the first level, yes, but maybe later we can also take the limit. We can also sum over different types of polygons.
In two dimensions, this is, of course, just, you know, what we know as Euclidean quantum gravity, basically. So we know that the shape of the tiles doesn't matter at all. So this is all covered by universality. So it doesn't matter. You use triangles or squares or pentagons or any mixture of those. So the in the continuum limit, the universal properties of that continuum theory, which is a kind of conformal field theory in that case, is the same.
Okay, so we could also do different polygons. Okay, and did anybody do dynamical triangulations for a negative cosmological constant? I mean, most of the papers are found were for...
No, that cannot be done. I mean, this is only a well-defined model for non-zero, non-negative cosmological constant, both at the bare level and at the level of the renormalized cosmological constant.
Okay, that's very interesting. So why is that?
Well, the path integral is not well defined. The non-perturbative path integral is not well defined because basically, you know, especially in Euclidean, of course, you have an e to the minus lambda times volume term in the gravitational action. So if lambda is negative, that, you know, that's a very divergent expression. So it can only be renormalized, you know, the way to renormalize it to get rid of this infinity is really effectively, I'm just rephrasing, by having the bare constant positive in order that the system has a non-zero radius of convergence, and then tuning in order to get to the continuum, one has to tune from inside the region of convergence to that convergence radius, and that implies that also the renormalized cosmological constant is non-negative. It's a free parameter, but it's not negative. So sorry to disappoint.
Well, okay, no, that's good to hear. But okay, so there's other possibilities what we could do. So in this low number of dimensions, of course, matrix models also come to mind, and perhaps people are familiar with this matrix model by Schenker, Sard, and Stanford, which is a matrix model for essentially for JT gravity. Okay. And there actually there's an idea of having a loop expansion by identifying the sides of the polygons. So if you have a square and you identify sides, then you get a genus one surface. But if you have an octagon and identify opposite sides, then you get a genus two surface. And so one possibility would be to construct a string theory loop expansion just from different polygons, which then means that we have to sum over different polygons. But then it's more like a matrix model string idea, and maybe we can circumvent this problem that you described, which, okay, I take the point.
Thank you very much, both to Johanna and also Renate. We still have a couple of minutes for another question. Fernando, please.
Thank you. Just a question for Johanna. Could you make more comments about the different binomial algebras that you were talking about, the type 3, type 2, and type 1? You were going from 3 to 2, but you didn't say how to achieve 1, and what is the relevance for that?
Okay, that's an excellent question, but unfortunately, I don't think there's an answer yet. What I did was to show how to get from a type 3 to a type 2 algebra. I mean, of course, there's these famous results by Witten and Loi-Toys and Liu and so on, and many other people working on this right now. But what I showed that this argument can be rephrased in terms of these very phrases. So that was also the answer to the early question that was asked. And so it's already super interesting that you can get from type 3 to type 2, but of course, if we really want to know how to get to type 1, we have to know more about quantum gravity. However, so the thing I was able to say that if we just take a very simple quantum mechanical model just made out of two spins that interact with each other, and that's type 1, of course, by definition. In that case, we have a lot of freedom to play with these things, and it's by design, it's everything simple because the Hilbert space is finite and so on. But many of these geometric constructions and these von Neumann algebra constructions can also be carried out in that case. So maybe it's a promising idea to see if we can somehow make progress from the two sides. So start from the finite dimensional Hilbert spaces where it's very easy to talk about a type one, and try to, you know, if you take many of these spins, for instance, to see if we can approach the issue of getting to type 2 and then come together from the two sides, from the quantum gravity side and from the quantum mechanics side. By the way, somebody asked earlier if foundations of quantum mechanics can be relevant for quantum gravity, and I was not fast enough to answer. So maybe I should say right now that of course, now these new developments of looking at the structure of Hilbert spaces based on von Neumann algebras, entanglement, and so on, that is certainly an example where the foundations of quantum mechanics, I mean, this work of von Neumann is almost 100 years old, have come to some new kind of renaissance in the context of ADS-CFT, and there are many extremely interesting new developments using these von Neumann algebras. And that's a very recent current research going on. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Maybe to switch gears, I have one question to Miguel. And so you mentioned in the context of a no global symmetries conjecture that one can get these beautiful constraints on the number of vector fields, like on are there similar ideas or similar possibilities to get constraints on fermions and scalars, or is it really just vectors because they are tied to the symmetry group?
Yeah, so the constraint that you get there is actually a constraint on the number of fermions. So it comes from, so if you can identify that there's a global symmetry in those theories, and then you postulate because of Swan-Plant that there's some effect that breaks them, and then the object that breaks them, because it's a generalized symmetry, it has a higher dimensional world volume, has some anomaly. So what you actually constrain there is the number of fermions. And what happens is that because these theories have supersymmetry, the super partner of the fermion, the fermion number you constrain is the gauge genus. So the super partner of that is a vector. So you constrain the number of vectors, But secretly, what you're doing is constraining the number of fermions. There's non-supersymmetric string theories in 10 dimensions, and their compactifications to 9, 8, and 7 dimensions don't satisfy this constraint in the number of vector fields, but they do satisfy it in the number of fermions. They don't have supersymmetry, and you really constrain the fermions. So it's really the fermions that you constrain. They're easier to constrain because of anomalies. It would be actually very nice to... Easier things to constrain are fermions and self-dual fields. It would be nice to have more techniques that can address other cases.
Thank you very much. And I think we are also getting towards the end of the session. Okay, yeah, so John still had a quick remark. So we have 2 minutes left. So
brief question. Is there any experimental test of string theory that validates it?
Well, not yet, but the way it usually goes is we try to falsify them, right? So we find, we make experiments and we check the predictions and we check if they work or they don't work. I don't think there's an experiment that can right now falsify string theory. I don't think there's really an experiment that can right now falsify any quantum theory of gravity, simply because quantum gravity is, so high energy. So, we just have to wait and see. It's too early to decide yet, I would say.
Maybe I can add some, given the discussion. Weinberg used to say that you cannot even rule out quantum mechanics. There's no test of quantum mechanics itself. You only test models, not the theory. And so you can see string theory like a framework of that. But anyway, so I can give you something that that people have considered. One thing is, if you consider special relativity and quantum mechanics together, then a la Wigner, so you get all the states that you can classify, all the particles, so massive particles, massless particles, and so on. And it so happens that the most relevant ones at low energy are the massless ones. And the massless ones fit into the representations of the little group that happen to be infinite dimensional. So we have no explanation from field theory if why these particles are not there. So Weinberg said that you haven't seen them, but you can forget about them. And Wigner said that they give you infinite heat capacity, so you cannot have them. That's an anthropic argument. But in string theory, it's very simple, because in string theory, the massive and the massless states are all related by creation and annihilation operator. So if the massive representations are finite dimensional, the massless representations have to be finite dimensional. And then it's a prediction that these states cannot be there. And they haven't been found. So, and it's not something that is just out of the blue, because people, actually two former faculty members here, Natalia Toro and Philip Schuster, they have been writing papers in the last few years trying to find a way and give physical motivations to test the potential existence of these particles. And all of these 10 to the 272,000 models that Miguel mentioned, they all say they should not be there. So if they find them, they can rule out these 10 to the 272,000 models.
All right, thank you very much. And I guess we are also running out of time. So thanks to all of you speakers for joining this discussion and for many interesting questions and answers. So yeah, thanks.